And so right now, I'm pleased to introduce Linda Marler-Hutchins, who is a hydrologist with the Massachusetts Department of Conservation and Recreation, Office of Water Resources. She is a liaison for hydrologic monitoring and scientific research with the U.S. Geological Survey Cooperative Program in Massachusetts and is a staff member to the Massachusetts Water Resources Commission. She's been providing technical support to the Massachusetts Sustainable Water Management Initiative under the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs and to the Massachusetts Water Management Act Advisory Committee with the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. And Linda will today be speaking with us about the sustainable yield estimator in Massachusetts water management. Thanks very much.
And check. Thank you. I parked the car in Harvard Yard. Can everyone hear me? All right. I'm from Boston. And just wanted to make sure you could all hear. All right. Today I'm going to talk about not really only the sustainable yield estimator, which is a tool that our U.S. Geological Survey prepared for us, but also some of the context around it, the Sustainable Water Management Initiative, and how we're using that SYE tool to go about water policy planning in Massachusetts. I want to thank Mindy and the Minnesota Groundwater Association for inviting us to speak today. I'm actually speaking on behalf of Kathy Baskin from the EEEA, who is the Director of Water Policy there. And Kathy couldn't make it because she has a son graduating high school this week, so that's a really good reason. But thank you all for your hospitality. I've really enjoyed being here. I've actually been in Minnesota now for about 24 hours, and I've learned a real lot this morning in a meeting we had yesterday. And you guys really have some epic potholes here. I thought we did well in Massachusetts, but man, you guys win. You've got them. I'm going to speak from here because I really can't see either of the screens over there, and I hope you can all hear me. If not, please, you know, give me a signal or something. And I'm going to use this guy as a pointer, and hopefully that's going to work. So I'm going to talk today. I have a lot to cover in a relatively short time. So I'll apologize in advance that some subjects are, you know, some of these projects I'm going to talk about, I'm just really going to be able to skim over and not really give you a lot of detail on. I'd be happy to talk with people offline after the conference or, you know, via email or telephone if you want to follow up with me. Mindy can give you contact information. So it's going to be a fairly dense presentation, I'm afraid, right after lunch. And but I hope to impart a lot of information and maybe relate to some of the things I've heard of what's going on here in Minnesota. So I'm going to talk today a little bit about our hydrogeology, just to put that in context with what you've got here, our state Massachusetts Water Management Act program, two topics that we are specifically wrestling with, which are safe yield and stream flow criteria, the sustainable yield estimator tool itself I'm going to go into a little more depth on than the other projects. And then, again, the context of our Sustainable Water Management Initiative. So I've never been to Minnesota, and I had to actually go online to learn some things, and I've learned it's the land of 10,000 lakes, or the Gopher State. And I'm from Massachusetts, which is the Bay State, also known as Taxachusetts. And what's really kind of outstanding or astounding to me is you've got a land area of about 10 times what we do in Massachusetts, and yet we've got a higher population. So I think that's maybe the source of why we ended up with water conflicts sooner than you did. You've got, you know, the same number of people spread out over a much larger area, and I think you've probably got some more prolific water resources than we do. And just so you get a little handle on the geography, this is Massachusetts. This is a map of our percent impervious cover. And you can see the eastern half of the state. This is the city of Worcester and east. This is Boston. Really pretty highly developed. To the western part of the state, we've got the Appalachian Mountains that run through our Berkshire County. And it's much less developed out in this area. There's a lot of steep mountainous areas, so it's not really suitable for a lot of development. And then we've got the Connecticut River. It runs south from the Vermont and New Hampshire border and the Interstate Merrimack River. But other than that, it's kind of local rivers. So most of our development and pressures are in the eastern part of the state. Whereas, you know, what I found out about Minnesota geology, and I've learned a lot more today, is you guys have aquifers that have names, which, you know, is kind of amazing to me. And these large groundwater resource areas and everything. And, you know, here's Massachusetts aquifers. They're in green on the map. Can you see them in the back there? Our aquifers we were a glaciated state as well, and we've got these little glacial valley aquifers that are pretty much just glacial alluvium in the river valleys, and that's the extent of them, so that's why you're not seeing a lot there. The glaciers came down and dumped a whole lot of sand in far southeast Massachusetts, and that's the green area you see here. All of Cape Cod should be green too, really, and Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. So this area of the state, the very, very far southeast, where we don't actually have that many people, has some pretty good prolific aquifers in the overburden. But as my colleague in Rhode Island, Elisa Richardson, says, our aquifers are pretty much Dixie cups compared to out here. So that's kind of just the context of what we're working with. And our bedrock, forget about it. It's granite. It's fractured granite. It does not transmit water. It's really not a high-yielding situation for us. We do have out in western Massachusetts an area of limestone, in the Appalachian Mountains, where it's really not suitable for a lot of development because of the steep mountains. But we do also have some karst issues out there, and a few unusual wells are drilled in that limestone formation that are just tremendously prolific. So it's rare, but we do have that kind of a situation out there. So one of the really smart things that Massachusetts did starting back in the 1700s, actually, was progressively built this large water supply system for Boston, for the Boston metropolitan area. And that it's the Mass Water Resources Authority. And then we have this large Quabbin Reservoir out in western Mass and a slightly smaller Wachusett Reservoir that this one feeds to, and then it all flows by gravity down into the Boston area and serves these communities. I think it's about 51 communities in eastern Massachusetts in that highly developed area. It serves 2.2 million of our population, so that's about a good third of the population in that highly developed area. And as you can see in the lower right, the system demand from MWRA, although our population has grown since 1985, the water demand has really plummeted. And that's that Quabbin Reservoir, you probably can't see it that clearly, but it has a safe yield of 300 million gallons a day, holds about 5 years of water. And they really did a big job of water conservation and tightening up the water system during the 80s. And you can see the result. They're demand plummeted from over 300 MGD down to 215 MGD today. So they've really done a good job. And I'll say Massachusetts is proud of being the first state in the nation that required low-flow toilets in our plumbing code for new development. And that gets a lot of credit, too, for reducing our water use. So it's not that everyone had to change over their toilets. It's just if you were building new construction, it had to be brought up to code with one of these new, like, 1.5-gallon flush toilets. So our precipitation pattern, I've learned that we get more rain than you do out here in Minnesota. We get about 48 inches a year of precipitation in Massachusetts, and it's about equally distributed over the months. It's 3 to 4 inches each month during the year. And of course, we get snow in the winter like you do and have melt in the spring. So kind of a typical river hydrograph in Massachusetts has about 2 orders of magnitude. This particular gauge runs from about 1 CFS to 100 CFS during the course of a year, with a high in the spring when the snow melts and lows in the summer. Wow, I already showed you that. And the real pinch point comes in the summer, low flow season, where we have really high evapotranspiration rates. The evapotranspiration exceeds our precipitation rate, so it's kind of a net loss situation to all the vegetation that's going on. Can't even rain enough to feed all the vegetation we've got, basically. And our streams rely on groundwater base flow. That is really the source of our streams in the summer months between rainstorms. The issue we have, outside of that MWRA system, most of the towns have some kind of a public water supply system that's in one of those tiny aquifers I showed you on the map. And their pumping can either intercept groundwater that was going to be feeding the stream nearby, because, again, they're all in those little valley aquifers, pretty close proximity to a river usually. Or in some cases, if the pumping is excessive, they can actually turn the flow around and induce flow from a river into the aquifer and into the well. And, you know, this infinite aquifer you see in the picture here doesn't even exist. You know, they're pretty small. They're just usually a few hundred feet wide. So again, our summer water demand is highest when our river flows are the lowest in the summer. So that's our real pinch point, and the biology is at its most stressed condition at that time. So in 1987, the Massachusetts Water Management Act was passed. And it's not regulated by my department, which is the Department of Conservation and Recreation, but a sister agency. My agency does more resource protection and planning, and the Department of Environmental Protection is the regulatory agency in the state. So they manage the Water Management Act. So all existing water withdrawals that used over 100,000 gallons a day had to register their use between 1981 and 1985 during this maybe 1 or 2 year registration period. So anything that didn't get in with a registration, the registrations were essentially going to be grandfathered. Anything that came in afterwards had to get a permit and go through this kind of arduous permitting process. Permits are subject to major basin safe yield limits, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, a pretty stringent environmental review along with public comment process, and water conservation standards are applied to permittees. They need to meet 65 residential gallons per capita day water use and 10% unaccounted for. Those two water conservation standards are fairly new. We hear a lot of squawking about it. The water suppliers don't like it, but nor do they really like the big increases in water use during the summer months. So sometimes I think it's easier for them to blame the state for things that are not popular, like outdoor water use bans, but it really does kind of help them in the end. So yes, we're a small state, but we have 27 major river basins that the Water Management Act uses for its regulation program. What they were supposed to do in 87 when the regulations were put out was to develop a safe yield or a cap on withdrawals for each of those major basins. So 25 years later, it still has not been done. There was so much haggling over the years about how to do it, it just never got done. So how did they judge when they gave out too many permits? They really didn't. There was kind of this rubber stamping thing going on when the permit applications came in. The town just needed to demonstrate a need for the water. Okay, so a lot of the environmental community wasn't happy with that. The safe yield, there's the definition, but I'm just going to read you the yellow parts. Maximum dependable withdrawals can be made continuously during period of years with the probable driest period. Such dependability is relative and a function of storage and drought probability. So it's really not an environmental consideration in there. It's really a water supply term. It's how much can you reliably get out of the hydrologic system, be it surface water or groundwater, during our worst drought. So it's really a water supply term. And, you know, where's the environment in that? The environment is mentioned in other places in the Act, but not really within safe yield. So in 2009, in response to a legal challenge, DEP was ordered by the court to issue safe yield. Okay, that makes sense, because an environmental group was suing on the claim that DEP had exceeded safe yield by issuing such and such permits. And all hell broke loose, basically. The environmentalists thought the safe yield values were way too high, didn't agree with them. There was no consultation. It was done behind closed doors. They had a fit. And one day I got up and safe yield in the Water Management Act was on the front page of the Boston Globe. The environmentalists went all the way up to the governor's office and had a fit, basically, and made enough noise and got enough press such that a few days later, after issuing these safe yields, DEP's commissioner clarified and explained that safe yield includes environmental protection factors, including the ecological health of river systems, as well as hydrologic factors. Now, they just made that up. You know, there's no basis for that. They made it up to smooth those ruffled feathers and then turned to their staff and said, how are we going to do this? What are we going to do? And thus was born the Massachusetts Sustainable Water Management Initiative. They gave us one calendar year to figure this stuff out, and it's now been a year and a half. The thing I don't think will ever die, I call it the Sustained Water Management Initiative. We have a technical subcommittee made up of stakeholders, an advisory subcommittee for policy type issues made up of stakeholders. We have agency technical staff meetings. So of the four environmental agencies in the state, about 12 of us get together in a room for a whole day once a week, and we have the most god-awful arguments amongst ourselves. The steering committee, which consists of the commissioners of each of those agencies. We have an implementation tools committee. So, you know, a lot of like what I was hearing this morning is going on here in Minnesota, only I think you all are taking a much more proactive, well-thought-out approach to what you're doing and doing it in kind of a more sane pathway and time schedule. We have just kind of been bullied into fix this now, you know, and it's pretty hard. Also, at the same time, there are some environmental groups that were going to our legislature looking for streamflow standards. And we thought, well, we'll just pull this into the Sustainable Water Management Initiative, too. But the lawyers didn't like calling them standards because that meant if you didn't obey them, you were going to be in violation, and we didn't want to set ourselves up for that. So their streamflow criteria, a lot of people hate that because they really did want a streamflow standard that couldn't be violated. But beyond that safe yield cap by major basin, this is intended to get down to more the local site-specific scale and really work at the impacts at that locale caused by that withdrawal and take into account things like seasonal variation and flow needs. Another thing that it's in capitals and italicized like that is because it got yelled at me. There was going to be no grandfathering. Anyone who holds a permit is going to be subject to these. And, you know, we were discussing some of the difficult issues at our meeting yesterday, and Dave Hamilton from Michigan said, oh, we got around that problem by just grandfathering everyone. Okay, that would have been nice. And that was actually the pathway that most of the agency staff thought we were going to be taking in Massachusetts, but someone several levels up told us, oh no, this is going to apply to everyone. So it just has made our task even much more difficult. Because now, imagine I've got a water system that's been there for 200 years, a surface water reservoir. The flow downstream from that reservoir is nothing like it was 200 years ago. And how are we going to accommodate our streamflow criteria at that location? We're really still grappling with that. So now I'm going to talk about some of the interagency research that's gone on in Massachusetts. And I have to say the vast majority of this has been done by our local U.S. Geological Survey office in Northborough, Massachusetts. It's the Mass Rhode Island Water Science Center, but sponsored in a cooperative agreements with the agencies you see here, the Massachusetts environmental agencies. And many of these slides I will be showing you were borrowed from USGS presentations, and some of them have some kind of tricky motions in them that I don't even understand. So I don't know if you guys are all familiar with StreamStats. Do we have that for Minnesota? No? Okay, StreamStats was kind of one of the first actions that was taken in probably over 10 years ago in Massachusetts. This was developed as a point-and-click application where a user could go onto this map of Massachusetts, select their location. The program will draw the watershed area, the drainage area, to your location, and then spit out a report with streamflow statistics. And it tells you some of the basin characteristics of that area and gives you a listing of the D50 to D99 statistics of the flow duration curve. So it's the low end of the flows for that river. Doesn't give you any of the high end flows. But it was a good tool to really start with because, again, that low flow time of year was really when we were having most of our problems in Massachusetts and most of the conflicts were coming up. Skipping ahead a couple of studies, we asked USGS, you know, we were trying to decide how far off from natural are our rivers, how bad is the situation, and how would you even measure it? We didn't really have reference flows or index flows to know how far off we were, even where we had gauges. Stream gauges, those gauges could be impacted by what was going on near it and upstream of it. So we asked USGS to classify and characterize our natural flows in Massachusetts and to try to group them somehow, if it was geographically or by basin characteristics. And they tried that. They found 66 index gauges, what they called index gauges, least altered gauges. So these gauges had more than 25 years of record and were in fairly undeveloped areas. And you'll notice on the report cover here from that project, they had to go outside of Massachusetts to find some of these unimpacted, undeveloped areas. They had to go up into New Hampshire, Vermont, Connecticut, and Rhode Island, and it almost makes it a regional study for southern New England now. And I know Rhode Island at least is taking advantage of some of that work. So, you know, it's not earth-shattering science, but it does kind of draw the line in the sand. This is what a natural flow should look like in Massachusetts. And something that deviates from these stream flows is off the mark. So now we know. We have our index stream flows. Here comes the sustainable yield estimator. So kind of at the same time, or just after we developed those index stream flows, our DEP, again, the regulatory agency, who's reviewing these Water Management Act permits, commissioned USGS to develop this tool called the sustainable yield estimator. It was started out being the safe yield estimator, but we didn't really want to use that terminology and mix up. This is sustainable yield estimator for a specific location. It's not major basin scale. It's right down there at the local withdrawal site. So what this tool does, in a sense, is it's kind of similar. It built off the technology of the stream stats. Again, you point and click at a location. It draws the drainage area. Only this time, we have built into this model a database of groundwater and surface water withdrawals and wastewater returns. So now we can do a little math with that natural stream flow. So what you're seeing on the right here of the graph is the difference between, and this is just, you know, hypothetical, a natural hydrograph, which would be the top line or the unimpacted flow, and then the impacted stream flow that's affected by withdrawals and return flows. So the math is pretty simple. They take the unimpacted flow estimate, they subtract off the groundwater withdrawals, the surface water withdrawals, they add back in wastewater returns that might be going on in that little drainage area, and you get a daily impacted flow out of that. Do you really trust it down to the daily? Well, maybe, maybe not. But they simulated these flows for an entire period of 1965 to 2004. So we've got 44 years of record of an estimated unimpacted flow. And I say, wow, just about that piece. I say, oh my gosh, what can we do with all this information? Even if it didn't do anything else, I'm really impressed with this program right now. So because it's something we couldn't do before, and stream stats couldn't do it for us. All stream stats gave us was the flow duration curve, and only half of it at that. So now I have, you know, daily flows. I can really pound a lot of statistics into that. The program also allows the user to put in target stream flows. So we can start messing with what if. What if we said, I don't want flows in August to be less than X CFS or CFSM, CFS per square mile drainage area, at a certain location? Well, now the program can go in and it will generate this curve for you and show you, you know, the red area is you're not achieving your stream flow targets with the withdrawals that are going on in that basin. So a pretty useful tool for permitting. This program was developed by Stacy Archfield, Dr. Stacy Archfield now of USGS, and she could really talk you through the statistics of this whole thing. I cannot. But basically what it's doing is when it draws that drainage area for you from around your site, it calculates the basin characteristics based on the GIS data that's behind it. It solves a regression equation that is linked to those 66 index gauges. So it essentially pulls the index gauge that is most similar in characteristics to it and relates that and creates a stream flow simulated for your site that takes into account its actual drainage area, its actually, you know, percent sand and gravel, its slope, its elevation, all of those things. You can talk to Stacy about all the statistics, and she's very brilliant and explains it very well. Okay, so that's the methodology I just told you. So some of the data sources that went into that were the index gauges, and it sounds like your quest to kind of develop this network of gauges and groundwater wells throughout the state is, you know, a tool that would let you build something similar to this. And we also then had to tap into the water withdrawal database, water discharge database, our MassGIS. For another project I'm going to talk about that springs out of this was the Mass Water Indicators. We also looked at some other GIS-based databases for dams and impaired water. A few limitations, and it's I think, kind of important to point these out. That's why you really couldn't deal with surface water reservoir withdrawals. When you are spitting out daily flows, flow estimates, it really couldn't estimate what was going on at individual reservoirs without a model of that reservoir, without knowing the capacity, the dam, the operation. They couldn't even go there in this round. If they had a database of reservoir information, then they could plug that in. But it wasn't ready at this time. And actually, subsequently, USGS has done what they call a firm yield study for us that does have a lot of that information on the reservoirs. And if we had funding, could be then plugged back into SYE, but we're not there yet. It also assumes an instantaneous groundwater withdrawal and surface water impact. So we're assuming a well that sits even, 100 feet off of a stream, when it pumps this drop of water, that drop of water actually came out of the stream and into the well and out of the system. So it's a one-to-one immediate impact, which we know is not true. There's ways around that, but so it perhaps overestimates some of the impact of pumping. There is a little routine called stream deplete that a user can go in and manipulate. That you need to know the aquifer transmissivity, the distance of the well from the stream, and I think the depth of the well screen. And then you can get that lag time of the impact from the river to the well and out. So that's just something you have to go in and manually tweak if you have the data. So again, it lets you specify in-stream flow targets, and then you can compare your results against those flow targets. There were some predefined flow targets that were put into the model. I won't go into those, or you can enter your own. You can adjust them if the results come out and say, oh, nope, you can't meet it. You can adjust your targets. You can also play what if with, what if this town wanted to add a new well? Where would be the best place to put it so it didn't impact the river so much? Or what if you wanted to discharge water here? So you can have the option of either adding or subtracting. What if we moved the well out of this basin and put it in a different basin? So there's a lot you can tinker with. You can tinker with the withdrawal schedules, all kinds of things in this application. We already went through that. So the results kind of get sent out into, exported into Excel, which is convenient because a lot of us can work with that. And you get monthly stream flow statistics. So it gives you, I think, the impacted, the unimpacted flows, and CFS, drainage area, all the basin characteristics. So it's kind of stream stats on steroids. It really kind of goes all out here. It gives you flow duration curves, impacted and unimpacted, and the daily time series that you can export that, And so it's very user-friendly that way. So the whole, you can see the tabs down at the bottom there of the page, of the Excel page, too. So there's just a lot of information that's put out. And, as a hydrologist before this tool, how much time would you have spent trying to find, a similar gauge and scaling the flows and making all these crazy adjustments? So it's really a great tool. It's been a great tool for us. So now I'm going to talk about some ways that we've been using SYE in Massachusetts in our quest for sustainable water. I have been using it for the safe yield issue. So now we're talking about the cap on each of the major basins and how much can be allocated. We essentially ran SYE for all of our major basins. So at the pour point of each of our major basins, we pointed the dot and said, tell me the statistics for major basin. I looked at the 90th percentile monthly flows, and we're using that as the basis for our safe yield determinations. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip through some of this stuff quickly. A lot of questions came up with, how conservative would that be of a safe yield? It's supposed to be that probable drought period, et cetera, from that definition. So we looked at our precipitation records that we have back to the 1800s, Massachusetts, and saw, for the period that we have stream flow record, 1965, was our worst year. And when I do a statistical analysis of that, I get a 98% exceedance probability. So to me, that's pretty close to the lowest probable condition, and I'm pretty happy with that one. But when I take this monthly Q90, it's kind of a synthesized year. Did it ever really happen that way? A lot of people are asking. So I actually went in and compared it to some real years, and if you can see on this graph, the green line is our median monthly flows for a given basin. The purple is what actually happened in 1965. The blue is our monthly Q90. So you can see that Q90 flow was even lower than 1965, or would be even lower than that 1965 drought year. So I feel it's pretty conservative. And in red is what we are proposing we would allocate as our safe yield. So we're talking about 50 or 60% of that base flow, that really low year flow for safe yield. And that's all on that. Furthermore, we have a study that USGS did for us, again springboarding off of the SYE work, that we call, in short, mass water indicators. And this is one map from that report showing our August flow alteration. And I'll kind of explain. There they go. what USGS did for us is they developed two static sets of basins. The one on the left is 1,429 small sub-basins, I call them, the small sub-basins, and 183 HUC-12s, and ran SYE in batch for the whole set. So all at once, 1,400 basins, and told us, were able to tell us a set of statistics that we could then map statewide. So talk about your broad brush screening analysis. This is it for us. And I think what you're looking at on both of those is August flow alteration. And what we're seeing in browns is flow depletion, and in blues are surcharged areas. So that's places where they're importing wastewater from outside areas and discharging it. So our August flow is abnormally high. It's higher than it would be naturally, which turns out the fish don't like so much either. Everything within this study is nested sub-basins. So if this is my sub-basin that's being analyzed, it actually incorporates the effects of everything upstream of it. So it's not just the teeny tiny sub-basin. It's everything that's coming down to it. I'm not even going to go into that. We had a stakeholders group, met for a year, four-hour meetings, very deeply technical, and selected what we wanted for parameters for them to calculate. Wish I had more time. And but what we found out from that was that we had them analyze January, April, August, and October flows. We found out that January and April, pretty difficult to cause an impact in Massachusetts. But August and October were kind of our pinch point months, which we knew, but you know, it was nice to kind of see it borne out by the data. And again, we have some of those surcharged areas that, what are we going to do about those? You know, how is the Water Management Act going to deal with that? They also did some GIS work for us and mapped dam density. I don't know about Minnesota, but Worcester County in Massachusetts has the dubious distinction of being the most dammed county in the United States, and that you can kind of see where that is. There are places where there is a dam every stream mile, and that's a relic of our industrial past that, you know, everyone, the settlers came and settled in the valleys and dammed up the rivers and used it for industry. So that's where we are. We have 3,500 dams. Most of them are no longer being used for their original intended purpose, and they're causing a lot of habitat fragmentation. The fish cannot get past them. And it's a huge need in our state to deal with the dams. They're also unsafe because they're not being managed. They're not being maintained. There's a lot of what we call deadbeat dams. We don't even know who owns them. And no one's, you know, oh, that guy died 200 years ago. You know, who knows? I don't own that. You know, and in some places, the little dam in the mill pond has become a historic attraction in the center of town. So, you know, there's a lot of social decisions that need to be made about those. And I think some 100 people could probably make a career of it. I'm going to skip this one and go right to the meat. One other study that's our projects have developed out of that SYE application that it's allowed us to do is link up all this GIS and flow alteration data with our fish data from our Department of Fish and Wildlife. The first step was Fish and Wildlife had to get their data out of their 20 file cabinets and get it put into an electronic database. And that took a couple of years. But what they ended up doing was trying to draw correlations between factors, stressors like imperviousness and dams, along with natural conditions like land cover, sand and gravel, and correlating that with where we have fish. And for the metric that they were measuring the fish community by was fluvial fish relative abundance. Fluvial fish are the ones that live in flowing waters and rivers, and they're different than what they call the macro habitat generalists, which are pond fish. They're pretty tolerant. They can live almost anywhere. So the fluvial fish is kind of what we're aiming for, and rivers should have river fish. And that's what the biologists tell me. I'm a hydrologist. Cut to the chase. So now what we had a preliminary study that was published about a year ago, and our final report that on the statewide analysis will be coming out in just a few months. September, I think, is the publication date. But now we have graphs where we can relate the effects of August flow alteration on fluvial fish relative abundance. And we can say that, you know, here's the data points. Most of the, you know, there's a relationship there. When you get down to about 40% August flow depletion, you're causing a problem. You know, you've lost a good number of those fish. And the same with species richness. You know, a lot of people react when we only start with six species of fish. Okay, that's just the way it is biologically from the glaciation. And, you know, when we start losing species, that gets people's attention. They're not rare and endangered or anything, but, you know, when we have six and we've cut it down to five, that's an impact. Another big finding of this study, and a lot of people had a sense of it, was that impervious cover is the other smoking gun. It came out as one of the strongest statistical relationships. And it may not be the impervious cover itself, but it's correlated somehow. The development is somehow correlated. It may be the road salt that's doing it, but it had the strongest signal, even more so than flow depletion, on impacting our fish. So the nature of development, stormwater, water quality, temperature, who knows what it is, but it's causing a problem for our fluvial fish, which does not say good things about the eastern part of our state. Anything that's in pink in this map is pretty much looking at, you know, look at the depletion, that the fish depletion that's caused by even, you know, 10% impervious cover. It's very, very strong. So it's, you know, we're at the point now of we've kind of lost the eastern half of our state biologically. Let's try to save the western half. So what we're doing with that, this fish and flow study, is letting us look at the biological loss that's being caused by different factors in the state. And make long story short, I'm out of time. We're assigning biological categories to each of our 1,400 little sub-basins. So now we know the characteristics, we know how much flow alteration there is, we know how much impervious is. We can throw that into an equation and figure out how much biological fluvial fish loss we're suffering in those areas. And we're categorizing our areas as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 biological categories. And there's a lot of 4 and 5 categories with high flow loss in the eastern part of the state, and the western part of the state's more the 1, 2 category. And the biologists are justifying their percents of fish alteration that we're impacting sensitive species up here with small amounts of flow alteration and impervious cover. In the middle, we're starting to lose species, and at the low levels, we're even impacting the more tolerant species. So we're really shooting ourselves in the foot. We've also taken a look at just the flow alteration piece of it to take out the impervious, because the Water Management Act really doesn't have a claw in to do anything about impervious. So we needed to focus in for them on what the flow alteration is doing to the fish and where we have opportunities to improve that. Honestly, a lot of the water withdrawals for public water supply, they don't have a lot of alternatives. In Massachusetts, aside from that big MWRA system, and that is limited in area as to where it can be used, which is pretty much metropolitan Boston. So we're also looking at just the flows, and you can see again, those blue areas are all surcharged. So it's really not a withdrawal issue there, it's actually a surcharge, and that was another piece that came out of the research, is that the fish almost equally don't like being surcharged. And we don't know if it's because the flow is not what they want, you know, the velocity is not what they want, the water quality is wrong, the temperature is wrong. We don't really know what it is, but we know they don't like it. They just don't want to live there. So we're using all this information, hoping to incorporate it all into a predictable permitting scheme. Because that's one of the big complaints we get is, you know, we send you a permit application. We don't know who's reviewing it, how tough they're going to be, how long it's going to take, how much money it's going to cost us to get through the permitting process. So we're trying to develop guidelines for both sides, for both the regulatory staff and for the permit applicants, so they can kind of have a better idea. And this is my last slide. I'm just going to wrap it up with kind of where we are with our sustainable water management initiative and how we're going to plan to feed it into the Water Management Act. Is on the left side, we've developed 3 tiers of review. So a tier 1 review is someone who's not even asking for more water. So they're going to kind of get an easy review. They're just getting standard permit conditions 1 through 8 that deal with conservation mostly and things like that. A tier 3 review, on the other hand, they're looking to cause an alteration in August flow that is going to make them change biological category or their flow level. and they're going to have to come in and do consultation with the agencies and do some mitigation. The table on the right is kind of where we are with our mitigation requirements. We're kind of working up a menu of mitigation based on how significant the impact of that withdrawal would be. So it just gives us a way to judge the significance of an impact, and then we're fighting and trying to balance how to make that impact or the mitigation commensurate with the impact. And that's kind of right where we are right now. We're working out the details of a lot of these things, and actually next week we're going to our committees, our technical committee, with those two documents to duke it out, trot it out in front of them. So thank you again. I've really enjoyed being in Minnesota, and be happy to talk to anyone.